I'm actually just going to read one poem. Since the category is poems written in a state of extremity, it seems appropriate. Work would fit in. I'm extremely excited to be here to hear from Joseph, as the book is completely extraordinary. What I would say about the one poem I'm going to read, besides that there's a few moments where which would be bleeped out if it was on television, but that also goes with Joseph's book. Since the imagination can go anywhere it wishes, or you wish it to, or some enemy demon wishes it to go, and since it can make the body go anywhere and take any form it can imagine, do those forms remain in the realm of the human just because we can imagine them and can represent them? And if we trespass into the non-human, the post-human, the pre-human, does it matter? And how does it matter? And does it mean? And how does it mean? So in this most extreme era for the materiality of our inventions, what are the implications of the human imagination's ability to manipulate the real, to represent and reinvent materiality? The poem I'm going to read sort of addresses some of those issues, but it's a little bit less abstract. It's titled with a line from Ovid to tell of bodies changed to different forms. Can you all hear me up in the very back? In the market of ideas, of meat, in the teeth of need, you will never be happy with your body. It is not the right body. The shame of having to appear in it, as if always a few steps behind it, or like a man standing at the edge of a small river which muscles by unaware, slipping by, under reflection, too fast for its own good, making you a fault in perception, a catastrophe to which a body is joined, disjoined, all headgear, undergear, tied, trussed, confused, wearing your arms and legs as if waiting for security to find you, shaven then unshaven, a bit traditional though all at once too raw, too sexed up, shivering portal and obstruction, seeing yourself there, features amplified, distorted by normalcy. What you are dying to be eluding you again, a hole in time, in the constellations of light, sublime heavy weapon of appearance being detonated right there where your eye meets your eye. I see you. How your apparition shrinks from itself. It knows there was another body it was intended for, another century, another love, another constellation, another sentence in which to place the heavy I, another race, sex, core, time, a different artifice, a different flow of faults. What are you dying to be? How unknowable do you feel, heavy ordnance with nowhere to hit? The thing about history is it drains, it flows, but has no borders. Is not this soft, smartly turned out green grove of summer? No places in it for insemination, iridescence, work. This being not yet you imitating it, a tiny nation state, which is your you. You can't understand it. You can look up at the sublime with its massive, firm edges, albeit under erosion. Who cares? You won't be around to see it. the altered thing, you who so need to be altered, that this could be acceptably a you, this thing which cuts loose from another's regard, the right ghost to be, yes, that, a want wanting to be all folds, all energy, an image filling itself in as almost but not entirely matter. It's late summer. We will never be happy with the body. We'll exchange it for another. We'll change its months, name, legs, arms, voice. We'll shave self off. We'll watch breasts grow as the buttonwood grows. The sublime is so alone. It watches us. Have you failed to make yourself? Are you still hidden? Are you too exposed? It's hard to tell. Perfect losses both ways. Too much body, too little. Voice too deep or too void. Voice too full of space, like a small nail trying to hold in too large a weight. Erect or not erect enough. Oh, are you built yet as you would be built? Caution, you will make yourself anew. Caution, you will not like the new one either. After a while, you will need to do it again. There is no body which will suffice. It's a theology, your mucus. It's a post-industrial cock or a derivative cunt. Are you getting ahead? Careful, you will get ahead of yourself. Indeed, you are ahead of yourself. I love you for that, says your best friend. I love you for your unquenchable dissatisfaction. After months so dry, rain came. So quiet at first, we did not know what to make of it. It tapped each thing as if a blind creature coming to see. We were where it was meant to arrive, weren't we? It went by too fast. Hard and fast, a kind of porn. I saw you feel your new ass. You like it, but then I saw you wonder whether right there where the idea of grandeur taxied down your piece of a brain and ready to go, but on cue, who knows how long it will be before you take off, and by then, wouldn't it be old hat? Warning, by then a new idea will have popped up, as if the runway weren't long enough or the sky too small. Change. The debt ceiling has shown itself to us. The undoing has shown its cheek, the lovely small of its back, the laminate skin of its sex appeal. There may be nothing else behind these words. By definition, caution, they too seek to be changed. Caution, you can neither be filled nor consumed. Caution, you are not beautiful. There is no such thing. You are a forced withdrawal from an occupied terrain. That's what the body is. Once you are out, you want to go back in. Not to the same place exactly, but back in. Back in. The same defiling of your corpse so that you can be resurrected as the new you and me thing. Look, a small mud wasp is building a nest. It actively wrenches the open air. There will be but this one. It will abandon its young, never to return. It is doing a form of research. The mud is powdery, like the foundation I have applied, looking so complete to myself in this mirror, in this instant, before the light changes and I must begin again. Thank you.
Are we mic? Are we set?
No, you are. You're mic.
Am I?
Yep.
Well, thank you, Jory Graham. And
oops,
I think leave that right there.
There
no?
we go.
And welcome everybody to this session, and welcome especially to Joseph Koerner, whom I will introduce very, very briefly, and then he will make a presentation of his book, and then we will have a conversation followed by questions from the audience. But I wanted to just say that Joseph Koerner is, I would say, the preeminent art historian of his generation. with many, many books now, each more astonishing and comprehensive and probing than the one before, but covering centuries and genres from the Renaissance, the Reformation, through to the 19th century. And we have now this remarkable book, actually, I'd say one of the most brilliant and urgent books I have read in a very long time, as it pertains both to its subject, Bruegel and Bosch, but also to our current conditions, which have been well named extreme. And I think one of the things I'm going to be listening for is just how Joseph has situated his deep reading of these paintings in a set of concerns that seem as urgent, as modern, as relevant to our conditions as could possibly be. And so I'm very happy to introduce the author of this splendid book, Bosch and Bruegel, From Enemy Painting to Everyday Life, Joseph Koerner.
Thank you, Peter. And thank you, Jory. Bosch is really an artist about the strangeness of the body, about an estrangement from the body. And that estrangement really is often one beyond words. If you think of this famous detail from Bosch's so-called Garden of Delights, it's sometimes called a tree man. Is it a tree? Is it a man? It's sometimes considered to be an egg. But it's on, you can see he's actually resting, he's a part of a boat structure. So he's a ship. Is it a ship? Is it a goose? Is it a proverb? Is it a bad joke? It is certainly a version of the shivering portal that Jory was speaking of, perhaps. And it is also a self-portrait of Hieronymus Bosch. I just say that as an aside, but he's looking back at the horror that he is. And over his body, sometimes literally in Bosch's art, in this case, it's just, you know that that's the case, is always written exactly that word, caution. One of Bosch's most amazing paintings actually has a gigantic kawe, beware, caution. All of Bosch's images have stated over them the word caution. Anyway, it's with a certain caution that you go and talk about Bosch. I decided to become an art historian, by the way, by reading the poets. My father was an artist, and he loathed art historians. I actually hated them as well. They would walk into our house, they would never look at the paintings, and they would begin to talk. They never looked, they only talked. So the last thing I wanted to do when I went into the university was to study art history. But I started to study literature, and I started to read a certain kind of writing inspired by art. Rilke on Cezanne, Auden, of course, on Bruegel, John Ashbery on Parmigianino. And I was fascinated by these responses, which seemed to me as good or more interesting sometimes than the paintings that they were responding to. And maybe because I grew up living, having to respond to my father's works and not finding really a good way to express that response, I found that these authors were very inspiring to me. My father's paintings puzzled me, but they didn't puzzle me as art historians are puzzled by the work. I knew what they were of, I knew how they were made. My father would go on and on about what they meant, and I became quite skeptical about understanding that, because he was not very good at talking about his own work. So you become skeptical also about the artist's own response. But of all the artists, Bosch and Bruegel were to him the greatest. They were, as it were, his two gods. And so it seemed natural to me at one point to start to work on these artists. But there was a problem, and it kept me from writing about them. The problem was that they're hugely popular artists, in a way. They're among the most popular painters in the entire history of art. They're the stuff of calendars and jigsaw puzzles. And in museums, you can find Bosch and Bruegel simply by following the crowds. They're famous. Some of them are famous, but the crowds don't come to these works because they're famous. They're caught by the works. They're caught by the excitement of seeing details, of standing in front of a work that draws you to it, often because of the great landscapes and huge spaces that they offer. The spaces are so vast you can't even take them in one glance, and instead you're drawn into details of the picture, and these details hold you, like here a painting by Bruegel showing at least 100 children's games. And so you're drawn into, for example, a detail like this, that little child who looks like he's got wings and he's a kind of angel in the flood there. But in fact, as you go up closer, you realize he's a child with swimmies, as they're sometimes called, made out of a blown up pig's bladder, which is a typical thing for Bruegel to show you, that all of a sudden you see that what seems to be strange and metaphysical is in fact very down to earth. A child's put on these inflated pig's bladders and is floating about in there. Now, the problem with a detail like this, as with all of Bruegel and Bosch's work, is that it's very hard, if you're in front of the painting, even to explain where it is. And the person next to you will probably be uninterested in finding it because they've found something else and will want to talk about it. And in the case of The Garden of Delights by Hieronymus Bosch, the problem is compounded by the fact that every object in the painting is not a normal object in and of itself. And so therefore you're caught up in an attempt to explain, I'm looking at the thing that the bear's standing on. What thing? Well, it's kind of like a shell. Well, I see a lot of shells. Well, it's the one with the three bruised buttocks in it. And then the person says, oh, I see the buttocks. But they're not allowed to say in public what they're seeing either. So because how do you describe this in the polite society of a museum, even to get the person there, that behind, which behind? I don't know. So the problem with these pictures is that they draw you into their mechanics, amazing machinery of hell. They draw you into their mechanics, but they draw crowds around those mechanics. They have pictures of crowds in them, and people crowd around them. And yet everyone feels often lonely in that crowd because everybody has a different response and is kind of autistically involved in the particular picture. So writing about Bosch is even harder than talking about Bosch in a gallery. I've found that students either find the explanations of pictures banal, or they find them correctly, completely implausible. Because there's something about Bosch and to a degree Bruegel that brings out the most esoteric and obscure in art historians. Art historians begin to look for ever more enigmatic, ever more puzzling solutions to these pictures, and all of these solutions are hermetic. People go on for pages in describing it, and yet it seems almost as if they're built to create interpretations that are plausible to the one person but implausible to the other. And that is one of the things that kept me from writing about Bosch and Bruegel. I didn't want to be those people who had a crazy theory about Bosch and Bruegel. And it's a strange phenomenon because on the one hand, these are works which give rise to esoteric solutions. And on the other hand, precociously, they're works that are extremely accessible. A painting like Bruegel's Peasant Wedding comes in the history of art in an amazing way at a point in which the history of art up till then, more or less, was a history of religious paintings. And when artists painted religious subjects, they nonetheless started to paint mythological subjects. And therefore expertise, scholarship, all the things that art history can bring to bear on a picture is really not necessary to these pictures. This is a picture of everyday life, and you can go to the party that he paints like you could have gone to the party back then. You're invited into the scene, into a scene of everyday life, and in everyday life, everybody's an expert. The art historians is no better an expert on life. In fact, they're often a worse expert on life. Bruegel paints a big space. These figures, when you see them in Vienna, are virtually life-size from the distance you view them. And you can step into that dance, and you can join the dance. And you might not know, it's true, you might not know what that flag is, but neither did people from the cosmopolitan town of Antwerp, where the painter was residing, perhaps know what the little village's symbolism is. So some of the obscurity is there, but the obscurity is one that's rather like a touristic obscurity or an ethnographic obscurity. Now, there are mysterious pictures in Bruegel's oeuvre. This looks like a village scene, perhaps a market scene on a Saturday, but the closer you look, the more you see that nothing makes any sense. Everybody's doing things that look plausible, like stretching from side to side the hand, but what it is extremely hard to make out until perhaps someone whispers to you the title of the painting. It's the Netherlandish Proverbs. And then indeed, one is helped by a book, perhaps, that one has at hand to find that this is a proverb in Dutch. He can't reach from one bread to the next, which means more or less it's an image for the way people spend their money before their next paycheck comes in. But the answer to these puzzles in Bruegel lies in common wisdom, in a wisdom embedded in the people, in the way people speak. So locally, Bruegel's pictures are solved with reference to local knowledge, common ways of speaking. The way in which we are as humans is that we are capable of speech. The solutions, the fundamental solutions to Bruegel's pictures tends to be that they are solutions that belong to the common nature of the human creature. Humans are people who use language and use it in figurative ways, like the Proverbs. Human beings are people who have strange rituals and customs, like this painting called The Battle of Carnival and Lent, in which it's a catalog of the rites and rituals of church and popular drama at the time. Humans are people who build, homo faber. Humans are creatures who build things like this great tower, but they build them, of course, erroneously. Bruegel, if I had time to shows that the spiral will fall over whether or not God damns them by mixing up their language. It's a faulty building, but nonetheless, humans build. And humans, perhaps most of all for Bruegel as a painter, as an imaginist, play. So language, custom, building, making, and play. Those are the definitions of being human. And so the answer to Bruegel's pictures are often the definition of the human. And a new kind of enigma then arises, what is the human? What is the human? In the case of Bruegel, the human is closely related to fantasy, to the ability to play act. And that reaches back for him to the art of Bosch. Bosch is also a playful artist. He puts together imaginary creatures. But the difference between Bosch and Bruegel, just to put it swiftly as possible, is that where in Bosch, on the left, it's a kind of monstrous creation coming from hell, coming from the diabolical. In Bruegel, the more you look, you realize, oh, it's just a peasant who's grabbed a leather mask, as our children might on Halloween in a couple days, taken a rug, got a pot, and made this squeaking pot to imitate the sound of a pig. It's from the closet of this person's home that the imagination of this costume comes in. So on the one hand, Bosch is an artist of the imaginative capabilities linked, though, to the diabolical, linked to evil, linked to the machinations of Satan. And Bruegel suddenly humanizes it and says all these strangenesses are the strangeness of humanity. It's not as in here another picture of Bosch in which the artist's imagination is there to conjure up the devils and illusions, deceptions, and satanic diabolical plots that are conjured up when a saint, Saint Anthony, tries to concentrate on his Christian devotions. And Bosch produces a kind of phantasmagorical imagery, but this is not the human that is being represented. This is, in fact, all the deceptions, all the parodies, like of religion, that the demons might do. So I began to wonder, how did we get from the one to the other, from a world of diabolical illusions to a world of the human? How do we get from Bosch to Bruegel? And I must say, it's not just my question. Bruegel asks the question himself, because Bruegel began as a Bosch imitator. One of the first works he produced is this wonderful engraving called with a title, "The Big Fish Eat the Little Fish." It was outfitted with an appropriate saying below. And you can see that at the lower left, it says Hieronymus Bosch fake it, which means Hieronymus Bosch made it. But in fact, it's not by Bosch at all. It's by Bruegel. Bruegel did the drawing. And he's passing his work off as a Bosch, partly because Bosch was an older artist. He died in 1516. This was made in the 1550s. But he's also passing it off as the older artist updated, transformed, enabling you to wonder, well, what is the difference between that 50 years that has occurred between the diabolical fantasies of Hieronymus Bosch, by then very famous, and this new form of fantasy? I would add that many of the paintings by Bruegel were cataloged as by Hieronymus Bosch. For example, this painting of so-called Triumph of Life, of Death, by Hieronymus Bosch, was only reattributed to Bruegel around 1900. And there was no signature, no date to do that reattribution. It was just something about the way the painting's painted, and I think more importantly, something about the subject, the lack of, for example, any divinity creating a judgment above in the sky, as well as the transposition of all the religious elements into artifacts, into those crosses, those almost useless crosses throughout the scene, and the fact that ultimately what this is the drama of human ends, of the terror of war, of death, and of the extreme state. The extreme state, states of exception, states of emergency. Both artists are masters of states of emergency, extreme states. In Bosch, the extreme state is a state of last judgment in which a wrathful God will probably destroy everyone, including the viewer. But it's also a state of personal assault by devils, by enemies, nameless enemies. And the pictures are constantly framing themselves as some omnipotent form of malice surrounding the self, surrounding the good, surrounding whatever center there is there, and sometimes even the center is diabolical, and then you don't even know where you are. Whereas in Bruegel, the state of emergency is much more like we would call a state of emergency today. It's often a political state of emergency in which the laws governing the locality have been suspended, and through a sovereign decision, a state of emergency and a state of violence has been declared. So here, the Massacre of the Innocents by Bruegel transposes the story of Herod in Jerusalem to a Flemish town, and he gives the soldiers of Herod the armor as well as all the accoutrements of the invading Spanish army to bring up to date the idea that the Netherlands in the 1560 was under siege, and that now, in a more general sense, the enemy, the cause of the state of siege, is no longer a metaphysical enemy. It's no longer the devil, Satan, even God's wrath. It's something internal to the enigma of the human, of why people inflict violence on one another. So my book tried to explain in different ways, or probably more describe, how one got from that one state of emergency, a metaphysical state with God and the devil vying with one another, to a new state of emergency in which it was all to do with humans and how humans act. There are many contexts, but I would just point to one, because in 3 days' time we will be, or some will be, commemorating Luther's posting of the 95 Theses on the church door in Wittenberg, and with that, the Reformation. Between the two artists lies the violence, uncertainty, and divisive characteristics of the Reformation, which included, by the way, a side of the Reformation whereby the enemies were not only the alternative confession for Catholics, the Protestants for Protestants, the Catholics, but also art itself became an enemy in the form of the way iconoclasts, here in a Netherlandish engraving of around Bruegel's time, represents it. So between Bosch and Bruegel perhaps lies these religious, socioeconomic, and political changes, but I think also we can roll the film forward and say that this question of states of emergency, of when laws are still in place but are constantly being threatened by some appeal to an order which has to suspend the law. The law is something which, either by divine will or by a human intervention, fragile, the law will be disbanded and all hell will break loose and humans will descend to a state of all against all. That's a situation, I think, that profoundly influenced Bosch and Bruegel and I think has some resonance still today. So I'll turn now to question.
Well, that was quite a trip. And thank you for that summary and introduction to the book. One term that I thought right in the subtitle could lead us into a conversation would be this very term, which you didn't really refer to that much in the remarks there, this idea of what is enemy painting. Mm-hmm. And I'm, of course, very urgently struck, as I was saying before, regarding the pertinence of this work to our moment, mm-hmm. our sense of living in an extreme moment in which even the rule of law may be suspended, in which there is a sort of overload of information that causes itself a kind of anxiety, as I see even in painting as innocent as the children's games. As a viewer, I'm worried that I'm not paying adequate attention the way you might be worried that you're not paying adequate attention to the internet or to the plethora of news or to split screens or to the multiplicity of images that are bombarding us. And that induces a kind of not just anxiety or panic, but potentially rage. And so I'm interested in rage in terms of the enmity that seems to have swept into our country at this time. But as it resonates with the kinds of enmity that you saw occurring in the 16th century and that is at work in particularly Bosch's paintings. So what exactly is enemy painting? And how is the animosity not just against the illusory nature of images that can trap us by their delusions and temptations, but something more aggressive in the human spirit mm-hmm. that I think seems to be expressed by Bosch in a way that keeps teasing us and holding us and gripping us so that there are crowds forming around these because there's some kind of identification, especially with the enigmatic.
Yes. Yes, I mean, just in terms of crowds, my favorite crowd scene is probably in Bruegel's Christ Carrying the Cross.
Yes.
In which everyone, it's this giant landscape, everyone is rushing through this vast landscape in order to get a good place in the ring of onlookers to watch Christ's crucifixion, including huge troops of children. Yes. It's the thing to do that day,
yes.
is to watch the crucifixion.
Yes.
And not piously,
yes.
but in some kind of, like in the Monty Python, you know,
yes.
the go to the stoning. But the question of enemy painting, I would perhaps try and describe it as follows. Every culture and many painters try and paint enemies. They try and imagine who the enemy is. Mm-hmm. They often stereotype the enemy. They caricature it. They try and make sure that you know it's the enemy. And Bosch does that. He shows all. He's a catalog of every enemy that a well-to-do patrician living in a town in the northern Netherlands might have had. They are the poor, they are the vagabonds, they are witches possibly, they are Muslims, they are Jews, every possible enemy. And Bosch paints these in a typical way of late medieval art. Enemy painting, in Bosch's case, and with the Reformation around the corner, also means that painting itself in this period has an odd location in the moral universe because images are idols. Images can be evil things. The images are lead people astray. And Bosch's pictures are filled with idols I-D-O-L-S, idols, mm-hmm. things that lead the mind astray. So enemy paintings can be the question of paintings themselves as enemies, as they will become in the iconoclasm. Those two more common understanding of the notion of enemy painting, enemy paintings of the enemy and paintings as the enemy, there's a third possibility, and that's, I think, what Bosch is uniquely the specialist, is to imagine what kinds of paintings and what kinds of images your enemy might themselves fabricate. And not only what might the enemy fabricate in their culture, there, according to the hatred towards the enemy, yes, that's projected, not only in their pernicious, nefarious culture, but what kind of images they might produce that have as their raison d'etre killing you. Paintings that are made by the enemy, inscrutable because they are by the enemy, which are shown to you, and you don't know what they mean. All you know is that they mean their destruction. So the closest analog, and it's something that in Bosch's time was quite commonly worried about, were the signs that arsons were said to make on the doors of people whose houses they want to burn down. So if you come home and you see an obscure sign, and you can't read it, you might think, well, it might be an arson sign, but you know you can't read it because it's not for you, but you know that it is legible because it's an arson sign. They are gathering to burn your house down. So it's actually legible to some people, illegible to others. So arson signs are a close analogy to what I'm saying an enemy painting is. So what Bosch goes to do is he not only paints the enemies, but he also paints forms of representation that he imagines, conjures up. Of course, it's all in his head. It's all in the cultural baggage of his own culture. What it might look like to see a painting come from the dark side, and not only the dark side, but the dark side that has you, that's the cautionary idea, that you as its target, that is actually targeting you and wants to do you harm. And the most famous example, I think, for me of that kind of painting is the so-called Garden of Delights, because it's a painting which looks like it's a friendly painting. In fact, it looks like it's a painting of free love and sexuality, where everybody has infinitely beautiful partners and there's no children interrupting. It's very nice. Everybody's approximately in their late teens and early 20s. But the whole display is there to catch you and to cause the very thing which the judgment scene, which overarches the whole scene, predicts, which is you're doomed from the start. So Bosch is an enemy painter in that sense. He paints the enemy, he paints enemy paintings, and he himself is, in the way that many artists of the Renaissance stage themselves, he purports to be an enemy. He purports to be of the dark side. The name Bosch, which he takes, is a play on being in tune with the darker forces of the universe, which are dystopic, entropic, and vaguely in some way to do with the nature of sexuality.
Mm. And so this self-reflexive element in which it seems to be exploring the potential evil even within the maker, perhaps even especially within the maker, his virtuosity, his extraordinary ability to paint as with such scrupulous, almost ferocious scrupulosity, has this very clouded underside in which it's part of some great scheme of illusion that seems to be entrapping,
yes,
us. When you had said that the tree man,
right,
in the right-hand section of the garden,
right,
is a self-portrait, I suppose to a certain extent Bosch's name also, not just obscurity, but the idea of the tree, Bosch, that there is something self-portraying about that. And I wondered if we could just look at it for a moment, because one of the things that we have an opportunity here is to have Joseph in front of the images, and I think there's nothing more thrilling than just hearing you speak about some of these images. But for example, if we go to the right-hand side and we see that tree man, I thought you explored it beautifully with this idea of, is it an egg, is it a... an interior of a shell that these creatures have moved up into. But can we look at a few other instances around it, such as why the ears that seem to be getting sliced through by a knife? Mm-hmm. And there's so much fascination with dispersed organs in Bosch, eyes, ears, but even in Bruegel, mm-hmm. that I'm wondering if there's something about fragmentation and disintegration mm-hmm. That is formally being achieved in these works yes. in ways that we won't really see again until mid-20th century abstract expressionism,
yes.
in which even the notion of an all-over painting rather than a painting that has a central focus. There seems to be something astonishingly precocious about these painters seeing their way through to something that we won't see. We won't see it in the Renaissance, we won't see it in the 18th, 19th century, but then all of a sudden we see this extraordinary wild proliferation and some of the causes of it, I think, again. But can you speak to one or two of the details that you haven't had a chance to share with us or that you might not have addressed in the book, because they each seem to be so suggestive and fascinating.
What you said is great. I think it's a great opportunity just to make one point. Bosch is emerged as an artist in the Netherlands, and the Netherlands was the center of really the, in my view, the greatest painterly revolution in the history of art. That is, the painting was transformed in the Netherlands in a way that even in Italy, the Italians couldn't believe their eyes when they saw the works of Jan van Eyck and Roger van der Weyden. They couldn't believe that paint could act in such a way that you didn't see paint on a panel. You saw instead the Virgin as you would most want to see her. You saw the Christ child in her arm, and the whole thing was projected with every bit of fabric on her clothes and every bit of her hair in the way it flows, as if you're looking into a world, a real world there that somehow paint magically produced. It's that kind of art that Bosch came from, and out of more or less nowhere. There are some precedents, maybe in manuscript illumination, but out of nowhere, this artist decides to take that technology of making things real in order to put forward something which is completely unreal. And in this case, the scene, if you think about it biblically, the only element in this triptych that is sort of concrete would be that we're seeing Adam and Eve meeting right after Eve's creation. Stephen Greenblatt was just talking about Adam and Eve. Here is Adam has woken up from his dream and he sees Eve. He hasn't been given her. It's not a marriage. They haven't been told anything about the tree of good and evil, the fruit of good and evil. They're just meeting. And he looks at her, and then that after that event, which the Bible hardly describes, after that event, everything, especially the central panel, doesn't belong to any narrative of biblical events. It's some never-never land that happens perhaps in Adam's head, but it certainly happens in the all-at-onceness of the picture, in the painting's ability to conjure up the fantastical in its almost classic formulation, things that don't belong together being put together. Some of the earliest descriptions about Bosch was that he was a master of the fantastical, of things never seen by human eyes, and of hybrid creatures. So the fantastical is there, but the whole thing is fantastical because it's a world that doesn't exist. It's kind of a utopia. And so painting, then, which can produce images of the real world so well in his tradition, are suddenly put in the service of producing a completely different world, a world that never exists, a world that only exists in the head. So in this picture, I think if I could cut a long story short, there is an aspect to it that's completely present. There's no single artifact, by the way, in the center which dates it to any period in history, let alone any period of art history. It's just sort of an omnipresent presence. It was a brilliant idea not to have any tools, any foods that are cooked, any equipment. It's all sort of natural order. So it's all present, but there is a story, and the story leads, it must be, from point A in the Garden of Eden via this mysterious point B, and whatever C is, it's a miserable end. And in this miserable end, a figure, the tree man, looks back over the story retrospectively. So mystified, perhaps, by what it is between the beginnings of history and the end of history, between the moment the human opened his eyes to the woman and this terrible end, which can happen at any time, and which I think is implicated in a kind of comical way into Bosch's own art, because this is a tree man, a Bosch figure at the end, that in this present moment, the whole history unfolds. And it does so in all sorts of ways that are extremely vexing, as you say, to our pictorial field. Most works of art of this period have a vector from beginning to middle to end. This does it, but instead, look at the circle. The center is a endlessly repeating, nightmarish, counterclockwise dance, a sort of circular dance, which is... So there's a timelessness, a stalling at the center. And what stalls you at the center, of course, is the painting. I mean, if you ever have the opportunity to go to the Prado, one of the things about this picture that just screams out is there's no other painting like it. It's because there's no other painting coloristically remotely like this. Blasts of colors, of pinks and blues and yellows. And it attracts the eye. Almost like a moth is drawn to fire. It appeals to ocular curiosity, and I think the story is also that is what troubled Adam in the first place. So indeed, the surrealists loved Bosch. Mm. Between the adulation of Bosch in the beginning, and he was, we now know, probably for a brief period of 20 years, the top artist in Europe at the time. Everybody wanted to own a Bosch. And then the works were pulled into princely collections, hard to see. They disintegrated, tastes changed. But at the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century, people rediscovered Bosch, and all of a sudden, indeed, he became the avatar of something that was simultaneously real and surreal, something that's fantastic, but at the same time, very, very concrete.
Yeah. Okay. I think... the idea is to have some questions as well, and I see the time is marching in ways that it doesn't quite march in the painting.
Right, it's not circular.
By all means, let's
not an endless...
open up, because I see several hands, and I think there's a mic that's available. Is there not? Otherwise, just shout out, and we'll do our best.
So I see your hand over at the far...
Against the wall, yes.
Yep.
There's a mic over there.
There's a mic over there.
Yeah.
It's six.
In the 16th century, yes? European civilization had many languages.
Right.
So pictorial language and pictorial storytelling gave the ability to transcend those barriers from region to region.
Mm-hmm.
And also literacy was much less common than it is in the present era.
Yes.
So pictures is what the church used. And mm-hmm.
Yes, I mean, if I could look forward to, maybe this is a good example, because it has for Jory, it has the beware, see, kawe, kawe, deus vidit. Not all of Bosch's works are obscure. In fact, some of them are really quite straightforward, and he is a master storyteller. In fact, one of the things I find so interesting is he's the creator of the entire genre tradition. The storytelling tradition that goes up through the 17th century in Golden Age Holland. He tells stories and pictures, and in this case, he transforms the seven deadly sins into little vignettes, which are quite fun to look at. Like the one upside down is gluttony. You have to look at the picture from the other side to see it. But it tells a story of gluttony, where the father is eating and the son wants more of that food, and no one has wiped his behind, so his trousers are filthy. And you can see it's a whole story about a family with an eating disorder. So gluttony is no longer a metaphysical or kind of just medieval category. It's a whole story that you get involved in. And yet, the strange thing about these pictures and here is that storytelling, the funny stories of everyday life, including anger, which I like very much at the bottom, that's anger at the base of things, turning everything around. The story is inscribed into another story, which couldn't be simpler, which is that everything that stories are about, all the fun and mystery and variety of human life, is all one spectacle for a God that sees you and is going to damn you with this disembodied eye. You see, the whole thing is an eye with an iris. So in Bosch, storytelling is combined with this super story, which is always the same nasty story. In the case of Bruegel, and maybe that'll be the way of discussing the question of language, very interestingly, Bruegel is not a painter who takes on the international style of its day, which is the Italian Renaissance style. He maintains this old Netherlandish tradition. So he speaks a local language of painting, one which links him to Bosch. But he also is very interested in all the things that are local, including the Netherlandish proverbs. They are Netherlandish proverbs. They're not other people's proverbs. They are Netherlandish customs. The games are games local to the community. So simultaneous with this idea of a broader cosmopolitan culture that painting could address, and simultaneously with the coming of the printing press and of the new way, new literacy, and the way that was implicated in the Protestant Reformation, painting itself started to wonder, well, what is a local kind of painting? How can I be a Netherlander painting in a Netherlandish tradition? It's in a way the beginning of romantic thinking about culture, whereas culture is embedded. There's a certain way of painting, a certain way of speaking, at the same time as it's saying it's universal, it's true of everybody, but I'm going to speak in a Netherlandish way, and if you understand me, I'll speak for all people. I sort of noticed a question there.
Yes. And then there was one in the middle as well, okay. Earlier on. Yeah.
At the risk of being reductionistic and putting Bosch on the couch.
Right.
Wondering if you had thoughts about where, to use your word, his diabolical worldview came from.
Right, right. I think his diabolical worldview was the prevalent worldview of the time. That is, it was the worldview espoused by sermons, preachers' sermons, guidebooks. The first printed books are the How to Die, the Ars Moriendi, a general sense that the end is near, apocalyptic literature. What distinguishes Bosch, I think, in all of this is that he just takes that worldview. He inflates it just to a slightly higher degree. Something which annoys a lot of people, especially I think annoys them about my account, is he gets rid of one element of the Christian religious temperament, which is love. If there's artists who are about love on one side of the scale and artists who are about hatred on the other side of the scale, Bosch is a little bit on that side of the scale. But it's not unusual to be about hatred, to yes. instill hatred. But perhaps what's peculiar about him is that he takes that diabolical story, which is standard ideological formation, and he appropriates it first for his art, an art that is the explosion of the diabolical into all its forms, and he takes on a persona as if he's in league with that diabolical side. Oh, his family, you know, actually, you really can't psychoanalyze because, A, we don't have any evidence, and B, it's a different period. But I would note one interesting thing is he came from a long line of painters, so he knows everything there is about painters. Some are mediocre painters. So he had a long line, fifth generation of painters, and he married very a very wealthy woman, and he seems to have been educated in Latin, And he seems to have been friends with the highest echelons of Northern European art. And so he's painting out of that local painterly tradition, but he doesn't need to make money. He's speaking to the founder of the Habsburg dynasty, Philip the Fair, buys his work. Only the top level of society is buying it. And in that world, unlike what one might imagine, it's really not so much about, I think, the unconscious. It's about a conscious enjoyment of cruel sports that you play on other people, particularly the people. And so it's a highly highly aristocratic kind of art, but with this grassroots animosity.
If I could just take the benefit of your question further, it does seem that this is another place in which the contemporaneity of that work, I mean, we are living in a moment in which notions of the satanic, of the end of times, of conspiracy, there's so much matching of the mentality and how that moves up to states of tyranny or states of exception. It really does seem as if we have a lot to learn by just thinking on the mentality, as if we've moved back into forms of a Middle Age mentality and sort of just wiping out the Renaissance. But there was another question in the middle over there, which I think we should try to get, and then we'll wrap up.
Yes.
Okay. What I wanted to ask was, I think something that's really enjoyable about Bosch is these paintings, which can be immense, and there's so many scenes and figures there, yet each viewer can kind of zoom in on one figure or scene that really transfixes them the most. Is there a single figure scene from Bosch that kind of haunts you, stays with you more than any other?
Yeah, I would say it's a scene which I had a kind of eureka experience with, which is, so in the picture, it's probably not for an underage audience, but in the picture, there's not a single instance of fornification. You know, people are doing things that might look strange with the spilling seeds and the flowers in the behind, but no one's really doing anything. Except in this scene here, there's a man coming up to the woman from behind, and right where you can't see it, there seems to be fornification going on. So what was interesting to me and why I liked that is because Bosch so cleverly puts it at the very center of the picture. He covers it up exactly where fornification would take place. The water has half covered and half not covered. And if you were to imagine a world in which people are listening to you, as they probably were when the painting was unveiled in the Brussels Palace, where we know it hung, and was opened on festive occasions, if you were to see that detail, like I saw it after looking at it many years, you probably wouldn't be able to speak it out, because why do you know about what's going on in that in that globe? And why are you talking about it? And I would imagine that perhaps notes would be taken about how people actually respond to the picture. So to me, that is the quite an interesting detail, where the detail is unspeakable, it can't be spoken, and yet somewhere in the artist's entire engineering of the picture is really almost engineered around that, when these panels open up and you see this little tiny detail. So if the devil is in the detail, as they say, in this case, it's literally probably in that detail, in the sense that that's where you know, aha, this isn't a world of blissful innocence. It's a world of adultery and fornication. But it's in the structure of things and behind closed doors.
I fear we've come to our 3 o'clock cutoff, but I really thank you all
very
much, and to thank Joseph.
Thank you.
And I'd like to remind you that this book and the book of Fast are available for purchase and being signed by the author. And this should become a handbook, not just a book on the history of art. We really need it. So thank you very, very
thank
much,
you so
Joseph.
Much,
yeah. Thank you.